Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable. Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Episode 128 of the Last Round Podcast. Thank you again for joining us each and every week, whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Boxing Socials, YouTube channel, our new mobile application, not ours, but the one we just jumped on. I believe it's called GeoSavin. It's in the country of India. That one's came up to like third place in our statistics behind the scenes over here, which is crazy. Sweet. But we got a big listening market over there in the country of India. So shout out to the country of India. But jumping right into it, this week, our guest, he was a staple in the Los Angeles boxing scene for many years until he left not too long ago. But he's still a staple in the boxing community, in the boxing scene. He's written for publications such as Boxing Monthly, The Ring Magazine, and he also has his own show, Montero on Boxing, which he's done, I believe, for quite a few years. I think it was one of the first ones, at least that I can remember, to kind of really gain some steam in the boxing world. Reporter and writer and what else? Maybe correspondent, what I could call you?
Correspondent, commentator. I've done some commentating, and I'm going to be commentating on some cards here in Atlanta coming up this summer. So I just kind of secured that deal. So
sweet. So if you guys recognize that voice, Michael Montero joins us this week on the Last Round. Thank you for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We appreciate it. So kind of jumping right into it, we'll start with fight previews of this upcoming weekend. Obviously, the big event from AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas on DAZN. Saul Canelo Alvarez defends his super middleweight titles against Billy Joe Saunders. Before we get your opinion on the fight itself, Mike, what obviously some news that happened actually today, the beginning of this week, is Billy Joe Saunders and his team had, I guess I'm putting it lightly, but concerns about the size of the ring. And then I believe Billy Joe's dad gave an interview to, I believe, IFL TV or one of the media entities there, saying there was no fight. And then for a couple hours, they were saying that they weren't going to fight. And then Canelo, they were asking his team, and all this big hoopla was going back and forth. When you heard that, especially coming off of this past weekend with Parker Jezora, with the whole situation that happened there, what was your initial reaction?
I tweeted about it. I said it's all bullshit. I don't know if I could say that.
Yeah, you can.
I obviously, look, man, he's not going to turn down this career high payday. He has a history, Billy Joe Saunders does, of finding his way out of big fights. He's done that before, but this is the biggest fight you can get. You know what I'm saying? He's been waiting his whole life for this. He's getting a massive payday. So this is all bullshit, mind games, to get in Canelo's head, to rile him up, to piss him off, to annoy him. And in the end, the bell will ring Saturday and there's going to be a fight. I'll just put it to you that way.
Do you think that, I mean, obviously Billy Joe Saunders has his unique personality like that. He's a little bit outspoken, but do you think that he saw last week Chisora kind of do the same thing with his in advance of his matchup with Parker? And do you think Billy Joe and his team probably decided, hey man, we should kind of do something like that, get some publicity out of it too?
I don't know like how premeditated it was. It may have been spur of the moment. It may have just come up because they signed this contract months ago and the ring size was not specified in the contract. There's nothing in the contract that says the ring has to be a certain size. So to bring this up now, Billy Joe Saunders hangs out with Tyson Fury and he's the king of mind games, right? He's pulled this kind of stuff a million times. So I just think that's what it is. And Canelo is the consummate professional. This isn't going to get to him. If anything, it's going to make him want to punish Billy Joe Saunders a little more. Maybe that gives Saunders a bit of an edge early on. You know what I'm saying? Maybe there will be some holes in Canelo's offense or something. But I think it, personally, since the minute this fight was signed, I thought that Canelo is going to win this 117-111. I just think there's such a vast difference in levels here. I think once Canelo figures him out in the middle rounds, that's it. And this is Saunders just trying to get in his head, gain any sort of advantage he can, because he knows what he's going up against.
Do you think, because of Billy Joe Saunders has obviously been inactive for quite a while, obviously the pandemic has affected a lot of fighters and stuff like that. But if Billy Joe Saunders, in your opinion, was a lot more active throughout the last, I guess, let's just say 2 years or so, a lot more fights, would you give him a better chance against a Canelo Alvarez this Saturday?
Maybe by a round or so. I mean, if he had actually gone through with the fight with Demetrius Andrade, and let's be clear, that was not Andrade that broke up that fight. It was Saunders with the nose sprays, you know, that whole thing. So that was all on Saunders. If let's say he had gone through that gauntlet and beat Andrade, well, maybe I'd look at him differently, right? But to date, his best win is David Lemieux, and not the best peak version of David Lemieux. I mean, Triple G destroyed and battered him. So by the time Billy Joe Saunders got to him, it wasn't the best version of him. So I just, people keep pointing to the fact that Canelo had a tough time with Irislandi Lara in 2014 when they fought, right? They fought in 2014, and that's the last highly skilled, high profile southpaw that Canelo has fought. But people are saying, well, Billy Joe Saunders is like a taller Irislandi Lara. Yeah, he is. But actually, Irislandi Lara has longer arms. I've talked to several people that have fought with Lara and trained with him. I was actually talking to Ishe Smith over the phone recently. We were talking about something else, but Irislandi Lara came up because he fought him. And he said, man, that dude's arms, his wingspan is like a light heavyweight. So I think Lara has a 75-inch wingspan. Saunders has a 71-inch wingspan. Canelo has a 70-inch. So there's not that much difference. The length, I actually think that Lara is a better fighter than Saunders. And Canelo has obviously improved since that time. I mean, probably 2-3-fold. And I'm just telling you, I would love to be proven wrong. I would love to see like a close fight, like a draw or so. You know, I think it's 117-111 Canelo.
And you're like, absolutely sure on the 117-111 card. Not like sure it's going to happen, but you're confident that Canelo is just levels above him. That it's just going to happen.
Because who has Billy Joe Saunders fought that's going to prepare him for this fight? Now, look, maybe there's a level there. Look, Tyson Fury, when he fought Vladimir Klitschko, I mean, I thought like most people did, Klitschko, even though he was past his best, he was on the downslide, I thought Klitschko was going to win that fight. And Tyson Fury showed us something that he had not shown up until that time, because he hadn't been in there with somebody that could bring that out of him, right? And then against Vladimir, he showed us extra levels, and he's shown us even more since then. So maybe we'll get that with Billy Joe Saunders, but there's been no indication through anything he's shown us in his career that he's on the level of Canelo Alvarez. Now, again, I'd love to be proven wrong, because a close fight, you know, a competitive fight, that's going to be more exciting. It's going to give us more to talk about. But I'm telling you guys, I think he's going to be more competitive than Callum Smith. I mean, that was basically a shutout. You know what I'm saying? So he'll win a couple rounds, 2-3 rounds. But yeah, 117-111. That's how I see it.
So obviously, Billy Joe Saunders a couple years ago, a year and a half, two years maybe. He had separated from Frank Warren, his longtime promoter at the time, and switched over to Eddie Hearn. Mike Shepherd knows over there in England, in London, that it's Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn. They're the two players on that side of the water, that side of the ocean. Billy Joe Saunders said recently that he was pretty irritated how Eddie Hearn was kind of promoting Canelo, marketing Canelo a little bit more, kind of taking his side, I guess, in a sense. What do you think about those comments? And, you know, does he have a point?
I don't think he has a point. Canelo Alvarez is the biggest brand in boxing. I mean, if you're Eddie Hearn and you're courting Canelo Alvarez because you want to keep him around, And he has this mission to unify the 168 division. And part of that is going to include him fighting Caleb Plant, who's at PBC, and PBC is going to want options on Canelo Alvarez to do that deal. You want to keep Canelo really, really happy because you want to keep him in your stable. So he's the top brand in the sport. He's the number one pound for pound fighter right now. He's going to get more attention. That just comes with the territory. Billy Joe Saunders, look, I don't dislike the guy, but what the fuck has he done? He hasn't done anything. Like he talks like he's this elite level fighter that's beat all these top guys. He hasn't. He comes off like an entitled, and some of it is mind games and craziness, but it reminds me of guys like Demetrius Andrade, Jermall Charlo, Caleb Plant, these guys that are just kind of waiting around for the Canelo sweepstakes, right? They should all be fighting each other, but they're not. So don't talk all this shit like you're not getting your what you deserve when you're not out there earning it. Now, again, I'm going to put it out there because I'll eat my crow. If he comes out there and fights, let's say it's a draw or like highly controversial, you know, so like the Triple G fight, let's say he puts it on him like Triple G did or something. I'll totally own that. I'll eat my crow. And then he will deserve that kind of respect. But he's got to go out there and earn it, man. That's how it is in boxing. This ain't the NBA or some shit. This is fighting. You got to earn it.
Mike Shepard, what do you think?
On the whole situation?
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of understood where Billy Joe's team was coming from. You know, when you go into the fight, we kind of know the only path for him to victory is a performance that someone actually put in last week, Sonny Edwards. I think Billy Joe needs to do a very, very similar performance to what Sonny Edwards did to win the IBF title. Same sort of thing. Just keep punching, moving. Kind of, it's going to be a boring fight to watch, but he's going to have to just constantly just be on his bike, try and pick up points. And I think that's the kind of performance we need. So he's going to need a larger size ring. I mean, obviously it was an oversight on his team. They forgot to obviously put, you know, what size ring or whatever. Obviously Canelo wants a smaller one so he can walk him down. Billy Joe wants obviously a larger one so he can keep away from Canelo. So I think that was kind of a bit silly, really, that wasn't looked at before, you know, kind of fight week. That should have been sorted in a fight of this magnitude. But looking at the fight, I kind of agree with Montero. I think that, you know, Billy Joe's never really done these performances. Everyone always talks about how great he is and what's he done. But yeah, you know, his best performance is probably, you know, that performance against David Lemieux. And if he hadn't have done that thing where he looked into the crowd, pretty one-sided fight, and we really probably wouldn't even talk about it that much, really. Just the fact that he did that, everyone found it so humorous that, you know, we kind of talk about it more than we really should, because it was just a one-sided beatdown, really. Apart from that, Andy Lee, you know, the performance against Chris Eubank Jr. before Chris Eubank Jr. really became the guy he is now. But yeah, he's one of those guys that's really kind of, you know, failed to live up to the kind of standards that he sets himself, and also kind of a lot of the British fans, I think, have him, you know, up there. And sure, I'm sure, like, you know, Tyson Fury and all the guys that he sparred say how good he is, but we haven't seen it under the lights yet.
Yeah, and that's all I'm asking for. Like, I'm not trying to be a hater, because obviously I see the potential in Billy Joe Saunders. He has talent. He has potential. I've heard the same things you guys have heard from guys that have sparred with him and trained with him in the gym. He just hasn't gone out there and proved it yet. Mm-hmm. So he's got to prove it before we can give him that respect. You know what I mean?
He reminds me of, he does these little things like James DeGale. For like a minute of a round, he'll look amazing. Guys will be throwing punches and punches against the ropes, and he's slipping them all. And you're like, dude, this guy's great. And then he just takes the rest of the round off.
Right. You know, you can't do that against Canelo. You can do that against John Ryder and guys like that, but you can't do that against Canelo. And that's why I say, unless he shows us levels he hasn't shown us before, which is possible. Again, I'll go back to Fury Klitschko. That could happen. I just don't see it.
What do you think about, Mike, is when, you know, people say those things that they say about Tyson Fury, Billy Joe Saunders, like, they have to, you know, be in there with somebody that they're kind of scared of to raise to that performance? Because we haven't really seen it with Billy Joe, so how would people know that?
Yeah, and he hasn't had to dig deep. He hasn't had to show an extra wrinkle. There's so many examples of this. You know, Dmitry Bivol is somebody who comes to mind, where he kind of coasts. He fights down to the level of his opposition. But when he's in there against the top operator, he looks brilliant. I mean, that performance he had against Joe Smith Jr. A couple years back, that's aged really, really well. You know, even his win over Jean Pascal. Jean Pascal has gone on to do some good things after that. Sullivan Barrera. So, but Dimitri Bivol, if you put him in there against, who did he fight last week? Craig Richards. He didn't look spectacular. He won every round, basically, but he didn't look spectacular. And that's what we've seen from Billy Joe Saunders. The difference is we just haven't seen him in there against an elite level fighter, at least not in a while. I don't know if he's ever been in there with an elite level top operator, and we're just not, we don't know what he's going to be made of until he gets in the ring. So there are more questions about Billy Joe Saunders than there are answers. The good thing is we're going to get answers to all those questions Saturday. And that's what makes the fight so appealing to me. And then also the fact that we're going to have tens of thousands of screaming fans. I don't know about you guys, but I've missed that shit. Like, I can't stand the quiet boxing. I'm over that shit. I was in Dallas for Estrada Chocolatito, the rematch recently, and there was a pretty, you know, decent crowd there, but it wasn't full capacity. But just seeing fans was nice. And I can't imagine it's going to be, how many fans are going to be in attendance? It's something like 70,000 or something.
70, yeah, about 70, yeah.
Dude, that's going to be awesome. I can't wait.
Originally 15,000, and then they changed it to 70,000. Billy Joe was kicking off about that. He's like, well, my purse didn't go up.
Yeah, he did say that. That's right. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. The guy's a character, man. I love it, because you say things like that, you get a response. And it's very similar to Tyson Fury. Who knows if what he's saying is 100% authentic or if he's trolling? You really don't know. Yeah. And that's why you kind of got to take it with a grain of salt.
I think doing it to Canelo, he's the uber consummate professional.
Yeah, Canelo is just going to.
Yeah, I think it's, if some of it is to try and get into Canelo's mind, he's doing it to the wrong guy.
Exactly. I agree.
Yeah. So Montero thinks it's going to go decision 117-111 ish. Shepard, what do you think? What's your prediction?
Just going off recent performances and stuff like that, because we've never seen this amazing performance that supposedly Billy Joe has in his locker. I'm going to go, I think Canelo on points.
Similar score, 117-111?
Probably wider, because it's Canelo. Mm-hmm.
I get you.
He's probably four or five rounds down just going into the fight, you know?
That is true. That's a good point. That is a good point.
And also quickly on that card, Elwin Soto goes up against Katsunari Takayama. I hope I pronounced it right, for the WBO light flyweight title. And also Kieran Conway goes up against Solmane. I hope I pronounced that one too. Sisko? Man, these names just get harder and harder for me every single week. This is for the WBA Intercontinental Super Welterweight title. What a mouthful that is. And then a Canelo stablemate, Frank Sanchez, the undefeated Frank Sanchez, 17-0, goes up against Nagi Aguilera. Really quick, Montero, what do you think about Frank Sanchez?
I like him. We got to, you know, see what happens when he steps up. We got to see what happens when he takes a big shot. If he can catch, we know he can pitch. Can he catch? I'm excited for that junior flyweight fight, though. I actually think that's going to be a sneaky good fight. When the Japanese dudes come over to the United States, and especially when they fight a Mexican, and especially when they fight a Mexican in Texas, it's pretty damn good. So the only thing about that fight is the age difference. I want to say Nakayama. I can't remember how to pronounce the last name. I think it's like 37.
Right.
He was a titleist at 105, moved up to 108. So he's got a lot of experience, but he's a lot older. But usually those guys bring it, man. So that's probably going to be a pretty fun little fight. It's a thin undercard, though.
Yeah.
Keyshawn Davis fights on there. I think his third pro fight. It'll be good to see him. He's a blue chip prospect. I was there for his pro debut.
Mark Castro, too, is on the card, I think, too.
I think so. So there's a couple of interesting prospects, you know, but it's a pretty thin undercard. This is all about the main event.
Yeah. Well, I mean, isn't that typical? Because all the money goes to the main event.
So. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like those old Floyd Mayweather cards, you know?
Yeah. And moving on for this past weekend from the Dignity Health Sports Park in Carson, California on Fox Pay-Per-View, the old StubHub, Home Depot Center, whatever you want to call it, the War Grounds in Los Angeles County. Andrew Ruiz Jr. gets the unanimous decision win over Chris the Nightmare Areola. Ruiz was actually down in the second round of the fight, which created some crazy entertainment, especially for the fans involved. What'd you think about, first of all, did you catch this fight live Montero? And if you did, what'd you think when Areola came over with that overhand right at that kind of that weird angle he came from and just knocked him down?
And Andy just rolled the wrong way. He tried to roll with it. He should have went this way. He went that way. Kind of gave the back of his head, the side of his head to Chris, and Chris took it. Chris fought, first of all, Chris Areola fought really inspired. I mean, everybody thought this was going to be a stoppage, including me. I wasn't shocked that it went to distance, but I was surprised. But Chris fought very inspired, put on a great, great performance. And the thing I like the best is after the fight, he said, I want a rematch. You know, he wasn't talking like a guy, because everyone looked at this as like a cash out, like a retirement pension check, you know? And he wasn't talking like that during the promotion. He didn't talk like that after the fight. He said, I want a freaking rematch. So that was really cool to see. Although I really do hope Chris retires, because he needs to. I wasn't surprised that Andy got put down. He's been put down before. But when Andy gets put down, he comes back and fights really, really hard, you know? I feel like I've been beating up on Andy all week. I did my show yesterday and talked about this fight, and I'm not trying to sound like a hater. I just don't see Andy Ruiz as this elite level heavyweight that a lot of people make him out to be. I mean, first of all, he's really a bridgerweight that is just overweight. And you know, people said, well, he was coming off a year plus layoff, but he came off a year plus layoff when he lost to Joseph Parker. You know, after that loss, he took it over a year off, and he's had crazy weight fluctuations before. He's gone up to nearly 300 pounds. I think he's been down like in the 230s at one point. So he's been all over the place, and he had been out of the ring for what, 15 months or something. Do people really think that this weight loss was a 15 month thing? No, it has been probably the last, you know, 3-4 months. So it is pretty extreme, but he's done it before. I just think that Andy is a top 10 heavyweight, but he's a lower tier, in my opinion, top 10 heavyweight. I think that obviously there's two elites in the heavyweight division right now, and that's Fury and Joshua. And then after that, you've got Wilder, you've got White, and you've got Parker. That's your top five. And then after that, it gets a little murky. Maybe it's Luis Ortiz, then it's Andy Ruiz. But all those guys, they're kind of interchangeable. So what Andy brings to the heavyweight division, probably better than anyone, maybe not as good as Tyson Fury, but he's right there, is he has a natural fluidity about him. He is a natural fighter. He doesn't think when he punches. And when he goes in there against, he's been sparring pro since he was a teenager, right? So he just has this natural ability in the ring, and he doesn't waste energy or anything like that. When he's in there with a really fundamental type of fighter, like an Anthony Joshua, who thinks about, if he sees a gap, he thinks about the shot, gets himself in position, then throws. Andy can be out of position and he'll just throw. It's natural to him. When he sees the gap, he fills it. AJ, Fury even, they get in position, then shoot. Maybe not Fury as much. So that's why Andy has an advantage over a lot of fighters in this division, but he is naturally smaller. And he's punching up at these guys, and he's so up and down and inconsistent in his training and everything. I just don't see him getting in there and winning titles again. I just don't, you know, but he's fun as hell to watch. And I'd love to see him against Deontay Wilder. I think that would be a great fight. It's not going to happen. You're going to get Andy Ruiz and Luis Ortiz probably on Fox pay-per-view later this fall. That's a good fight, but I'd much rather see him fight Deontay Wilder. I think that'd be a really, really fun fight.
Mike, do you think we just all got kind of carried away with that one performance on Andy Ruiz against obviously AJ? Because, you know, literally weeks before that, he was fighting, Dimitrenko for, you know, pocket change at the StubHub, I believe. And you think that just that one performance kind of got us all carried away?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I tweeted the other day, I think it was over the weekend, that Andy Ruiz is this generation's version of Corey Sanders, the South African fighter that upset Vladimir Klitschko, except I think Corey Sanders was better. I think Corey Sanders was taller, longer, punched harder, and was more athletic. And even his hands were probably as fast as Andy's. So this generation's Corey Sanders in the sense that on any night he could be dangerous, especially early on when the guy is cold. If he could drop you, hurt you, rock you, like he did to Joshua, and Joshua was just never able to recover. But I really do think he hit the lottery that night, man. He's not going to be the same guy. I just don't see it. But once again, I'd love to be proven wrong. And he is with the hottest trainer in boxing right now, the hottest camp in the sport right now. So that can only help him, you know, going down the road.
Do you think, Montero, do you think that, because obviously when he coming off his win for in the first AJ fight, gained all those titles, he kind of got the fame thrusted upon him, the money, the fame. He was on all these late night shows in the United States and just all over the place, you know, from 0 to 100, pretty fast. And then I think reportedly, I think the commission reported that, or the official purses for him was $1 million, for this fight, the reported purse, at least. I mean, do you think that now that he's had a couple fights where he's made some significant amounts of money, he has, you know, he's been able to take care of his family, himself, security and stuff like that. Do you think maybe that's affected him, and maybe the hunger in him that he had in that first Joshua fight maybe just isn't there anymore?
I think he's always going to be a hungry guy because of where he comes from. I just think people don't change that quickly. And I've talked to several people. Andy Ruiz has worked with a bunch of trainers, right? There's been guys, I think Justin Gamber, the guy who trains Caleb Plant, at one point he was training guys for Top Rank in Vegas, and he was training Andy Ruiz. And I talked to him, and I can't remember the exact number, but he said it was something to the effect of like, man, we had like 40 training sessions set up, or it was some, a number like that, all mapped out in the calendar, and Andy showed up to like a dozen of them. You know, and I've talked to several guys who say things like that. He's just always been that dude. He's just naturally good at boxing. He could get in there and kind of do it. And he struck gold that one night. Yeah, the fame did get to him, especially when he went down to Mexico. I think he met the president. Yeah. I mean, he really, really was big down there. And even here, of course, you know, in California, big time. But it did get to his head a little bit, but he was always kind of that dude. He's just a dude from the block that, you know, if everyone's drinking a few beers, he's like, ah, shit, give me one. You know what I'm saying? If everyone's eating some tacos, ah, shit, give me one. He's just that dude. And that's why people love Andy. And I think now, you know, maybe he is in the Reynoso camp. You can't have no shows. You got to show up. So I think that's going to keep his weight down. He's going to be more regimented and everything. But is he ever going to reach the pinnacle of what he did with Joshua that one night? I don't think so. Joshua was compromised coming into that fight. He was not 100% healthy, and that's not an excuse. And to AJ's credit, he hasn't used it as an excuse, but he wasn't 100% healthy for that fight. And when they fought in the rematch, you saw the levels. And I get it. Andy had ballooned up in weight. But also Joshua fought smart. He fought backing up. He used his length. And you just saw the levels. If they fought again, I think Anthony Joshua would win again big.
In terms of Chris Ariola was obviously upset at the judge's scorecard. He admitted, he acknowledged that he lost the fight. He said, yeah, I probably lost the fight. But he was just upset that at the scores. Actually, the scores of the fight were 117-110, 118, and 118-109 twice. Do you think he had legitimate concerns about that in terms of, did he deserve more, I guess, more than two or three rounds?
I scored at 9 rounds to 3 myself. I didn't think it was that close of a fight. I think too many judges and too many fans and too much media now, grades on a curve. And when they see a guy doing better than they thought he was going to do, they give him rounds. That's not how you score rounds. You score rounds on who won. And from the middle rounds throughout the second half of the fight, I thought Andy was controlling things. Chris fought well, and he landed some shots here and there. But for the most part, it was Andy doing the work. So I thought Chris won maybe 3 of the first 4 rounds. But after that, it was tough to give him a round. So the two judges that gave him only 2 rounds, yeah, maybe that was a little bit wide. But at best, you could give Chris 4 rounds. So that, I think that would be very generous. That's the fight I saw.
Right. I gotcha. Also on that card, Arizlani Lara, former world champion, gets the first round KO over Thomas Lamana for the vacant WBA middleweight title. What'd you think about WBA Lara's performance? Yeah, exactly.
Jesus, how exactly is that sanctioned? I talked about this on Twitter too. Cornflake Lamana, no disrespect to him. he had no business being in the ring with Irizlandi Lara, especially for a quote unquote title fight, right? Lara had never fought at 160 before. Yes, he had the title before at 154, but that was a while ago. And the first fight at 160, why is he in a title fight? So this is just the WBA doing what the WBA does. But that was shameful that fight was sanctioned. But props to Lara for getting in there and taking care of business and making it quick.
Right. Also on the card, Sebastian Fondura, the towering inferno, gets the fourth round TKO over Jorge Cota. I mean, what do you think about him being, I think, 6'6" and making 154 pounds? What do you think about
that? He's a problem, dude. He's not going to be able to make 154 forever. He's going to settle in at 168. He'll fight at 175 at some point. But for the next couple years, if he can keep making 154, skill-wise, yeah. Is he up there with Jermell Charlo or somebody like that? No. But, dude, just... They call him the Towering Inferno. That name sucks. They should call him the Freak. I mean that respectfully. Sebastian the Freak Fondura, because he is a physical freak, man. I've never seen a guy. And they always add an inch or two in boxing. You know what I'm saying? This dude's really like 6'5", 6'6", and he gets down to 54. He's got crazy long arms. Crazy long arms. And it's difficult to get inside of that, man. Once he masters the jab, in fighting at a distance, because he likes to mix it up on the inside. As he steps up, he can't do that as much. He's going to have to, you know, pull back and lure guys in. But getting inside on that guy, that's a problem.
Yeah. Do you don't think he's going to have maybe the same type of issues that someone like a Paul Williams had trying to get opponents because of his size? You don't think he's going to have the same thing?
The difference between him and Paul Williams is he's going to have more, there's going to be more financial incentive, I think, down the road to fight Fondura, because the Mexican-American fan base is going to be behind him. So he's going to bring a little more financial muscle to the table. He has a great personality. He's young. He's really, really young and just getting started. So yes, he's going to have trouble, but he's going to have to work his way up through the sanctioning organizations. But he'll work his way into, he might be a mandatory already for one of them, if I'm not mistaken, or close to an eliminator. So that's how he's going to get his first title probably. But I think that down the line, he's going to have a pretty good fan base.
And then Abel Ramos gets the win over Omar Figueroa Jr. In a fight from what I've seen. And then I was surprised too, that it was as wide or, you know, as one-sided, especially after the first couple rounds as it was. What'd you think about this matchup?
Great performance by Ramos. And he's a guy that's been grown up the hard way. When he was at 140, he fought Maurice Hooker. He fought Regis Progre. He fought Ivan Baranchek. He came up short in those fights, but that was great experience. And then at 47, he's had a couple of tough fights. So this is a guy that's come up the hard way, and all that experience really served him well. Figueroa is doing this weird, like he dipped to this side and covered his face, dipped to this side and cut. I don't know what he was doing. And it was giving Ramos something to think about the first few rounds. But once Ramos figured it out, he was just shooting straight down the middle, just using angles, moving his feet, getting in position, pop, 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 pop. And he was just beating up Figueroa, who's really never should have moved up from lightweight, should have stayed there. So great performance. Now, is Ramos going to get in there and compete with the top welterweights in the world, like Errol Spence or Terrence Crawford? No, he's not on that level. But some of the other top 10 guys, I wouldn't mind seeing him in there against like a Sean Porter or somebody like that. Sign me up for that.
Right, right. And before we let you go here, Montero, we appreciate obviously you coming on always here on the last round. We wanted to get your take on the unfortunate situation. You know, the Felix Verdejo situation and the young woman who was tragically killed. I mean, what was your reaction when you heard the news about that? And now that he's been charged, you know, what's your take on the whole situation?
Yeah, I did a very detailed breakdown of all the latest information on my show, The Neutral Corner, on Ring TV yesterday. And I had Jacob Rodriguez from New York Fights on. He called in. He's been following the case extensively. He's pretty plugged into the Puerto Rican media. When I first saw what was going on with Friday, Keishla Rodriguez was reported missing, I think, last Friday. at least that's when it went public. You know, at first I didn't want to talk about it, tweet about it, because I just wanted to collect information. And so what I did this weekend and into Monday morning is just collect info and talk to a few people connected to the Puerto Rican media. And then, of course, I read the FBI affidavit, broke that down, and kind of deciphered that. I was in the Marine Corps, so I've seen a lot of those government documents, and I know how they're written, and it's you can really read a lot into what's if you look at the verbiage, you can see things, what's there and what's not there. And you can kind of you can make assumptions based off that. So there's certain things I noticed that it kind of dispelled some of the rumors that I've heard related to the case. There's a million rumors, you know, and I just want to stay away from sensationalizing it, talking about the rumors, glorifying any of this. It's absolutely a tragedy that this woman, and apparently she was pregnant with Verdejo's baby. That's what she had told her family and friends that. I don't know if the coroner or but I don't know if they've substantiated any of that, but we're supposed to know by Wednesday. They're supposed to give us the cause of death. From what I heard Monday, it was 48 hours. They were going to have all the reports on that stuff. Was it her being assaulted by Verdejo and this accomplice? Was it the serum that they injected her with? I guess there was substances they injected her with that killed her. So we're going to get more details here this week. But it's an absolute tragedy all around. And one thing people, you know, obviously you think about this woman and her family, and everybody in Puerto Rico is affected by this. But this is an issue in Puerto Rico. There's a lot of violence against women down there. And that's something that I think is kind of fallen under the radar. Some of the folks I've talked to in the media down there said that this is something that's happened more and more in recent years. And that's why they did not grant bail to Felix Verdejo and his team. They wanted bail. That was rejected. And I think they're going to try to speed up this case because there's been several high-profile cases. Jacob Rodriguez, again, when I had him on my show, he was talking about one in 2019 that's still ongoing. So I think they definitely are going to try to rush and get to this. The FBI is involved, so it's a federal case. So because of that, I do think it's going to make it more high-profile and they'll rush it. But, you know, Felix Verdejo's family, wife, kids, and his extended family, they're victims in this too. You know what I'm saying? This affects so many people. It's just terrible when things like this happen. And we have to wait and see everything play out, you know, and get all the information. But that's the thing is, I think there's people tweeting on all kinds of stuff on Twitter. I've seen people saying the woman deserved it because she was messing around with a married man. I mean, that kind of stuff's ridiculous. And people commenting on the rumors and stuff need to chill with all that and just let the case play out and stick to the facts.
It was, it's kind of like how Edwin Valero was back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking about that. Did that cross your mind too when you heard about the situation?
Of course. And a friend of mine brought it to my attention that Valero had also been in, I think, a motorcycle accident a year or two before all that and had serious head trauma. So who knows if that's related here, I don't know, but I've asked around, and the difference in these cases, because there are parallels, there are a lot of parallels, but the difference is there is zero history with Felix Verdejo with assault, domestic violence, nothing. The only, and it wasn't even a criminal incident, but the only law incident where it got involved was his motorcycle accident where that was reported in media and everything. But from every report that I've seen, there's been no incidents of violence with him and his wife or any ex-girlfriend or any, there's been no arrest for assaults with a guy or anything, you know, at a bar fight or something. So this just completely comes out of left field. With Valero, there were some of those incidents before. It's been reported that there were incidents like that. And with the head trauma that he had, he couldn't get licensed to fight in the United States. And that's why he started fighting in other countries. So there were issues there. With Verdejo, this is just out of nowhere. That's why it's so shocking. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, it's definitely an unfortunate situation and very tragic and you know, in any way you look at it. So, you know, like you said, let the process play out and, you know, we'll see what comes out as the days move forward. But Michael Montero, we appreciate you once again coming on here on the last round. You know, you're welcome anytime. Before we let you go, go ahead and plug your show. I believe you do one or two a week, and your social media. Go ahead and plug it, man. The floor is yours.
Yeah. So you can check out my work in Ring Magazine, ringtv.com, and the Ring Digital YouTube channel. My show, The Neutral Corner, we go live every Monday, 5 p.m. Eastern. The video is live on Ring's YouTube channel, and then the audio pod comes out on my platforms Tuesday. And you could just find those on Montero Unboxing. If you look up Montero Unboxing, whatever platform you prefer, whether it's Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, whatever, look for Montero Unboxing. You'll find me. And if you want to follow me on social, you know, it's Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff, Montero Unboxing.
Sweet, sweet. Well, once again, Mike, we appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, we'll do it again.
Michael Montero. He's definitely good at talking, giving his opinion. He's very well informed on the whole boxing scene. He was very well informed on the Felix Verdejo situation. I was glad to know some new details of just based on him talking to us about that. So that was very interesting. But once again, our thanks to Michael Montero of the Neutral Corner and Ring TV and the Ring Magazine. Moving on, fight reviews. This past Saturday, the 1st of May from the Manchester Arena on DAZN. As we touched on earlier, Joseph Parker gets the split decision win over Derek Chisora. This was for the vacant WBO Intercontinental heavyweight title. Chisora, like we mentioned, was trying to, you know, cause some scene leading up to the fight, about walking out second, you know, and then there was some type of coin toss and Parker won the coin toss. And then there was all this situation and whatever. Before we dissect the matchup, Mike, what'd you think about when Chisora made a big old deal about the whole walking out second thing and the whole coin toss? What'd you think?
You know, it probably was for PR, and I could kind of see where Chisora was coming from. You know, it was, you know, it's in the UK, like his hometown. Neither of them were bringing, you know, a title into the event. You know, Parker was coming off a, you know, suspect win. Chisora was obviously coming off a loss. But, you know, I can see what Chisora was saying. Like, you know, if there was going to be fans there, you know, they were mostly would be his fans. So, you know, it would kind of make sense for him to walk second.
Is that true, though? They would mostly be his fans?
I would say so. I mean, he's very popular. That's why he's on pay-per-view. You look at the fight. It's like we just said, like he was coming off a loss to Usyk. Parker was coming off a very kind of suspect win over in New Zealand. But yet it was a pay-per-view event just because of us, you know, both very popular. You know, Parker's used his social media very well, especially during COVID times, to make those funny videos, you know, which kind of, you know, got him across to a lot of fans. And, you know, Chisora's just, you know, crazy, which I think, you know, a lot of people kind of like, because you never know what he's going to do. Is he going to come in and be very mellow? Is he going to turn a table upside down? Is he going to have a fight with David Haye in the crowd? You know, all the other stuff that he does, like threatening to pull out so he can get more money. And he's just a crazy guy. You never know what's going to go down. So I think that's why people, you know, enjoy watching him. But yeah, I could, it probably was just a PR stunt, you know, just to try and get a few more people there. You know, to buy it, since it probably wasn't doing great numbers, and I don't think they've actually kind of released. I haven't seen any figures at all yet to see how well that did. But the fight itself, I thought Chisora got it. I thought Chisora obviously knocked him down in the first round, and then I thought he probably won, you know, five or six of the first, you know, six or seven rounds. I thought Parker left it a little bit late. I like the fact that, you know, Chisora was kind of really pushing the fight. He was the guy that kept coming forward. You know, at times Parker would connect with like a little flurry of two or three punches, but kind of like what I said in the preview last week is, he just looks like he's a heavyweight Adrian Broner. He just kind of comes in there, looks to really go 12 rounds, throws the odd punch here and there, kind of just to show the referees in the fight. Even though we had Chisora rocked in the 11th against the ropes. Didn't jump on him, kind of took a few steps away. Didn't, you know, I don't know whether he just doesn't have the gas tank. At times, I think it's he doesn't want to commit and he doesn't want to come into range to commit in case he gets caught. That's what it seems like to me, that I think that, you know, after getting that payday against AJ and stuff like that, you know, he comes across as such a nice guy. It's just, I don't know if he's really a really kind of like, you know, angry street fighter in there. And I think now he's just gone through that Adrian Broner case of, you know, just picking up wins here and there, picking up nice paydays and, you know, just as many as he can before, you know, he kind of just rides off into the sunset. You know, I thought Cesaro really, you know, took this by a round. So, you know, I wouldn't call it a robbery, you know, as a lot of people were, because I think it was a close fight. I had Cesaro winning it, but, you know, Parker by, what was it, 115, 113, 116, 111, and 115, 113 to Cesaro. So I think the scorecard that was 116, 111, I think that was the, you know, the thing that kind of pushed people over the edge. And they said it was a robbery because it just that scorecard was just outrageous. I just don't see Parker winning that many rounds, especially due to the fact that he got dropped in the first. So that was a 10-8 round. So that scorecard was a little bit lopsided. And then obviously, do we want to see it again? It looks like they're going to run it back maybe on the undercard to fill a card. I don't see it. It shouldn't headline another pay-per-view. But like we kind of touched on, you know, if you're going to stick it on the undercard of, say, for example, AJ and Fury, if that gets made, like we just said about the Canelo card, a lot of the money in those big events goes to the main event. So there isn't much else to go around the rest of the card. That is why you often see prospects filling up the rest of the card. So are they going to want to pay, you know, Parker and Cesaro kind of pay-per-view money to be a co-main? I very much doubt it, because I'm sure, you know, most of that 150 million site fee is going to go into AJ's pocket and Tyson Fury's pocket.
Right, right. Especially with the history that Cesaro has showed leading up to fights, he's definitely not going to want to be the co-main event to a Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua. I just feel like he'll at least make a big deal out of it, like he does in situations. But you mentioned that you thought Cesaro edged it out. So do you think the 115-113 was an appropriate score for Cesaro?
Yeah, I think so. I think that he kind of took the first like six rounds or so, six or seven rounds. And then obviously he had the 10-8 round in his pocket as well. And I think he kind of gassed, you know, he probably lost like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And then I would say he probably edged the 12th maybe to win it. Because, you know, he just kept coming forward. Parker really didn't do a lot. He's, you know, Cesaro was putting a lot of money in the bank by, you know, Buddy McGirt kind of telling him to go to the body and go to the body. And it was amazing to see Cesaro turn around to Buddy McGirt and be like, yes, coach. Sorry, coach. I was like, Jesus Christ. You know, normally Cesaro just gets in there and does what the hell he wants. So I wonder if we'll see him and Buddy McGirt working together again. It was kind of nice to see him show him some respect to, you know, a Hall of Fame fighter and coach like Buddy McGirt.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, talking about Joseph Parker, you said you compared him to like an Adrian Broner type, right? I mean, we talked about Andy Ruiz with Michael Montero earlier in the episode, how Andy Ruiz kind of hit his peak after the first AJ win. And he's not, I guess, I don't think Montero called him overrated, but he's not what everybody thinks he is. Do you think Parker is possibly in that same similar category?
100%. Yeah. I said it last week. I thought he lost the Ruiz fight. He only got that because it was over in New Zealand. He fought Anthony Joshua, did the same thing, was too scared to commit and just ran around for the whole 12 rounds. Fought Dillian White, you know, lost that fight, but technically, like in the 12th, he had pretty much Dillian White was so gassed that, you know, if there was, you know, a round or two more rounds to go, he may have got him out of there, but it was the 12th round, so there isn't any more rounds, but, you know, hypothetically. And then who else have we had him? Obviously, the Cesaro fight, I thought he lost that. When he fought Junior Farr, he was lucky. I think the fact that he was, you know, massively the A-side against Junior Farr, an up-and-coming fighter, and the fact it was in, you know, in New Zealand. I know they're both from New Zealand, but Parker's the biggest star over there. It's kind of like Canelo. You know, I'm sure Parker was probably three or four rounds up on the judges' scorecards going into that fight, and he didn't look great. You know, and that's one of the reasons that he says he changed coach, and, you know, he's kind of got a little bit stale with Kevin Barry, and he joined Andy Lee. I just don't think he has it. I just don't think he has that, you know, like in Rocky where he says, you know, you've become civilized because he got all the money. that's kind of what it is. I think he's become civilized now and he doesn't have that hunger anymore. He doesn't have that drive. And I think, you know, personally, he was a little bit overrated. They kind of gifted him the WBO title, you know, and he kind of just sold that to AJ. And I haven't seen a great performance ever since then. You know, coming up, he did throw a little bit more. He was kind of heavy-handed. He threw a lot more combinations. He's kind of actually kind of similar to Andy Ruiz. You know, he had good hands, good fast hands. I just don't think he's world level. I think he's just kind of, you know, thereabouts. And he just kind of sells his name as a former world title holder to people now. And he's, you know, luckily picked up a few, you know, favorable results against Junior Farr and Chisora. And, you know, he can keep chugging along as he can at the minute. So, fair play to him. And, you know, it's just up to Andy Lee, I guess, to see whether he can catch that, you know, eye of the tiger, as they say, and, you know, turn him around. But I'm sure he's a wealthy man. He probably doesn't need it as much anymore. So we'll probably see him pick up some more paydays and then just ride off into the sunset.
You said Parker sold his WBO title to Anthony Joshua a couple of years ago. Would you compare it to Prince Charles Martin selling the IBF title to Anthony Joshua as well?
Yeah, 100%.
Same type of deal right there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, Charles Martin even more so because of the fact he picked that up by that heavyweight got injured, didn't he? He got injured in the fight, and you know, obviously Charles Martin picked it up, and then you know, they kind of jumped. I think Eddie Hearn's openly said that, you know, they kind of moved faster and bought that world title from Prince Charles because he kind of was like, oh my God, like that guy's terrible. You know, we can pick up a world title. So they kind of picked that up. And then kind of like we've talked about Ryan Garcia before, you know, Anthony Joshua was then a, you know, world title holder, but he kind of wasn't up to that standard. So they kind of had to move him a little bit quicker. And, you know, AJ's obviously done very well. You know, if you look at his resume, he's fought a lot of the big names in the top 10. He probably on paper actually has a better resume than Tyson Fury.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. But Fury's, it looks like
Fury's never fought like Povetkin, Pulev, those guys.
Right. No, right. I mean, I think I've said it before. I think, you know, a lot of people look at Fury as a better heavyweight, but then there's people who look at Joshua as a better heavyweight. I think just based on resume, I would lean towards Joshua just because he's been in there with the more competitive and dangerous opponents. It's not to say that Fury isn't, you know, can't be the best heavyweight in the world, but I think if you had to pull my arm and make me pick one, I would have to choose AJ just based on the opposition he's been in there. But you know, if Eddie Hearn's correct and that fight is supposed to be announced soon, then we'll dive more into it. I don't think it's going to be announced anytime soon. I think it's going to fall apart if you ask me, but is that what you think they're going to announce it Saturday?
I think that's what they do sometimes, isn't it? They'll do
that's true.
Big main event. And then I don't know what the closing or
just. Well, Fury, I think Fury is supposed to be at the fight, I think. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you think that AJ is also going to be there too?
I don't think he can. I think because of the visas or something.
Oh, that's right.
I think Eddie touched on it in an IFL interview that he couldn't because he's not working, so he couldn't. Oh, okay. He couldn't get a visa. But I believe obviously
you know that would have been awesome because remember it kind of like remember when they announced Canelo Triple G won, they announced it after the Chavez Jr. fight, I believe, and then they did it like WWE style. Triple G comes out and then they meet each other in the ring. Max Kellerman of HBO starts interviewing them, and that could have been really big for the event. You know, if AJ could fly over and Fury's here, have them both announce it and put them both in the ring with Eddie Hearn right there, and boom, have like Todd Grisham or whoever asked them, like, all right, you guys ready? Yeah, boom, and have them do like a little face off and boom. Imagine the publicity that would have gotten. Just imagine that. But we'll see. But I think you're right. I think it's a good point. I think they're gonna announce it Saturday, if anything, and they're gonna bring Fury into the ring and or at least interview Fury on the side of the ring right there and kind of go from there. So that makes total sense. Moving on that card, Katie Taylor remains undefeated 18-0 with a 10-round unanimous decision win over Natasha Jonas, who suffers a second loss of her career. Taylor retains her WBC, WBA, IBF, and WBO lightweight world titles. with this win, Mike, does your opinion change, or is Katie Taylor still the best pound for pound female fighter in the world?
Yeah, she's the GOAT, as they say.
Whoa, you better be careful with that.
I think so. I think she's the GOAT. I think she's better for the sport in general than Clarissa Shields, if you want me to be honest. I think, you know, if you think of like just the way that she is as a person, she interviews well, and you know, she's just a all round nice person, you know, good sportsman. Just very, I don't know.
Well, what'd you think about her win?
I thought it was a close fight, to be honest with you. I thought actually Katie Taylor would have, I thought she was going to be too good for her.
Yeah, no, it was close.
Yeah, it was a close fight. You could see that like early on, I don't know whether it was the size difference, because obviously Natasha Jonas moved up a weight category to fight Katie Taylor. But Katie Taylor won, I would have said, probably the first like five or six rounds pretty easily. And then I don't know whether it's Jonas, you know, grew into the fight, kind of maybe got, you know, used to the power, or maybe it was just the event was kind of big. But yeah, I think like round five or six, she kind of woke up, and then it was Jonas kind of took over. You know, if it was a 12-round fight, or if it was, you know, 3-minute rounds, could have been completely different. I thought it was a good fight, though. Very close. It was good to see that, you know, Jonas came back into it and made it more competitive. But the problem is I'm sick of these 2-minute rounds. You just need 3-minute rounds, because you kind of start watching it, and then when you realize that, you know, Taylor can take Jonas's power and Jonas can take Taylor's power early on, you know, oh, this is going 10 rounds. Because, you know, if you watch like a lot of the fights normally, say like, for example, Beterbiev, you're on the edge of the seat because you're thinking like, hey, if he connects clean, this is over. So you can't look away. You can't really look at your phone. You can't go out the room to, you know, get a drink or some food or whatever, because you don't want to miss it. Whereas in a, you know, a women's fight, unfortunately, so far, like, you know, it's going to go 10 rounds. So you can kind of go do something, come back, and you can kind of watch it, you know, because it's very, very rare, unless it's, you know, Tanisha Estrada fighting that woman that just looked like she'd been picked off the street. She got, like, knocked out in, like, I don't know, 9 seconds or whatever it was, you know, literally just...
That was in Indio, right? The Indio, yeah. Fantasy, you know, Space Casino.
Unfortunately, they all just go 10 rounds. So it's, it kind of takes that element of boxing away, where you don't want to turn away from the screen, you know, because anything can happen, and you could blink and the dude flatlined, you know, he's just out because of, he's been connected clean. So yeah, I think we need to change something. I don't know whether it's just going to be the 3-minute rounds, or, you know, the generation of fighters get better and better and better and better, more powerful, you know, more, you know, the fitness gets better, and we just get, you know, a better quality of fighters. Look at the, you know, for example, the UFC, you know, if you compare the talent they have now to back to when, you know, Ronda Rousey first started, you know, hopefully we get that in, you know, women's boxing.
Right. Absolutely. Moving on that card, Dmitry Bivol retains his WBA light heavyweight world title with a 12-round unanimous decision win over Craig Richards. You know, we touched on Bivol earlier. Bivol, I don't think he, even though he gets the win here, it becomes harder and harder for him to land a marquee name or somebody of competitive value. And I don't think this fight, even though I think Bivol, if you had to ask me, I think I've said it in last week's or the week before one of our episodes, if you had to pull my arm and ask me who the best light heavyweight in the world is, 175 pounds, I'd say Bivol. And a lot of people would say Beterbiev and, you know, throw Joe Smith Jr. in there. I think it's Bivol. I just think Bivol just hasn't had the chance to show the world in there with one of the marquee guys. I mean, Marco Montero mentioned that the Joe Smith Jr. Win has aged well, which it has aged very well. But, you know, fighting guys like a Craig Richards here that, you know, who's that, you know, and it's just, he's high risk and low reward, but it doesn't mean that he's not good. It's just, you know, it's like Andrade. It's same thing. Like, I mean, I don't think, like, I think Canelo and like Triple G and those guys would still be heavily favored over somebody like Andrade, but for Andrade, he's just kind of like low reward. So I don't necessarily think he's high risk. I think he's good and he's got talent, but I think if you had to compare him and Dmitry Bivol, Duvall has is very high risk and low reward. I mean, what do you think? And then also, what do you think about the matchup?
I'm starting to think whether Bivol really is a 168er. And I'm thinking, you know, he reminds me of Lomachenko fighting at lightweight. He's that good in terms of technique and stuff like that, that he can do it. But, you know, a lot of the fights are going to go the 12 rounds and he's going to outskill them. But, you know, he's smaller. He can't really knock them out. But in terms of just, you know, general skill, boxing IQ, he can cope, you know, because Bivol, you know, he's doing well. And originally I kept thinking, like, is it just that he can't really get the good fights? And I did wonder whether, you know, when he fought Lennon Castillo and the fight wasn't that great, I was like, okay, maybe it was just a little bit of bad matchmaking and, you know, Castillo was kind of negative and that was why the fight kind of stunk. But now I'm starting to think he's a 168er that just fights at 175 and he's kind of like a Lomachenko. He's just physically just not big enough to really, you know, knock the guys out. But, you know, the boxing technique and IQ is, you know, gets him through. You know, the fights are going to go 12 rounds and he's going to win, but unfortunately they're not going to be great. I mean, he obviously, like you said, you know, he did beat Joe Smith Jr., but I just wonder, is Beterbiev just going to be too freaking big? Because that guy is a monster. You know, I'm sure that he's probably boiling himself down from 190 to make 175, whereas Bivol probably walks around at about 175, because, you know, he could probably make 168 pretty easily. And, you know, he might do to fight Canelo in the future, you know, maybe next year after he's picked up the, you know, the title against, you know, Caleb Plant.
I think his team has mentioned that they'd be willing to go down to 168 for a marquee matchup like a Canelo. So,
yeah, no, yeah, they have said it. But yeah, in terms of what, like you say, you know, it's like risk and reward. He's good. Unfortunately, even more so now, you know, his last few fights have kind of stunk the place out. So if you're an opponent, are you going to be like, you know, one, the fight's going to suck. Two, he's good, so I'm probably going to lose. And three, it doesn't generate a lot of money. So why would you want to fight him? The chance to maybe win a WBA title, you know, that's on the table. But yeah, he's in a tricky place. He really is in a tricky place.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, he's a very tricky place. I mean, he's probably in the trickiest place in all of boxing. If you had to, like, identify one fighter in all of boxing and all the weight classes, who is in the, like you said, the trickiest place or the between a rock and a hard place, my choice would be Bivol. You know, you have like Demetrius Andrade, like we talked about and stuff like that, but I think Bivol has it the worst. And you know, like you said, he can make 168. He most likely could make 168. But then who's to say that if he goes to 168, that they're going to treat him the same? He's just not going to be able to get any of the marquee guys, you know, like who's to say that doesn't happen too.
And the problem is I think he's still signed to Matchroom.
Right.
Obviously this was a, you know, Matchroom card. So I think he still is signed to Matchroom in DAZN. If he goes down to 168, he can maybe pick up the Canelo fight, but you know, a lot of the other guys are on the other side of the street. And then obviously, you know, if you're looking at the light heavyweight division, they're all with Top Rank.
Right.
So, you know, Top Rank and Matchroom do kind of work together. So that's probably more viable.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tricky.
I could see Canelo in the future just based on like him fighting all these guys and wanting to unify and stuff, especially after the Caleb Plant fight, assuming he beats Saunders this weekend and fights Caleb Plant later this year and really, you know, unifies all the titles at 168. I could see him saying, all right, you want to fight Bivol? Let's fight. You know, like whether he tells him to come to 168 or maybe Canelo says like, I'll go up to 175. I mean, it's a dangerous fight, but like you said, Bivol's not really, he's not a really big 175 pounder, you know? So in terms of size and stuff like that, I think Kovalev was a bigger guy than Bivol when Canelo fight him, when Canelo fought him, excuse me. So, I mean, yeah, the risk would be high, but I think the only person between 168 and 175 at the moment who would, you know, who would fight him just because he's like, yeah, I'll fight him. I don't care. Like I'll take him on just because he's shown that, you know, his competitive side, would be a Canelo. I mean, Eddie Reynoso has said in the past that they were even considering going back up to 175 and fighting Beterbiev. You know, they said that. I mean, like you said, like Beterbiev is like, what, 190, maybe 200 pounds, and most likely boils down to 175 pounds. Whereas Bivol probably walks around at maybe 175, 160-ish, 165 around there, you know? So in terms of like size, you know, Canelo would be more at more of a comparative, you know, matchup with somebody like Bivol instead of somebody like Beterbiev. But yeah, he's in a tough spot, man. And I think, like I mentioned, I keep saying it, I said it like three or four times already, I think Bivol is the best 175 pounder in the world. I really do. I think if you put him up against Beterbiev and these other guys, I think he beats them. But he's stuck in such a rock, between a rock and a hard place, that, you know, are we ever going to see it? Or are we going to see it when the first time he fights some opponent and he doesn't look as good as he's done before, you know, or maybe he gets knocked down or whatever, but he still wins the fight. Do all these other fighters then look at him and say, hey, I think he's, you know, decreasing in his talent. Maybe we should fight him now. You know what I mean? So I don't know, but he's definitely in a tough spot. You know, he's like him, like keep going back to the comparison, him and Andre, you know, I think those are the two closest, fighters that you can compare each other with. It sucks, you know, it sucks seeing all these big marquee names fight around your weight class, especially 168, and you're not getting a piece of that pie. You know, it sucks, you know, and I'm sure it's frustrating, but you know, it is what it is. Moving on that card, Chris Eubank Jr., former IBO world champion, gets a 10-round unanimous decision win over Marcus Morrison. What'd you think about Eubank's performance, Mike?
Strange performance. I could understand, you know, at times he wanted to get the rounds in. Obviously, with working under his new coach, you know, Roy Jones Jr., even, you know, they have been together for, I think, like 18 months, you know, since COVID hit. So they have been together a long time in the gym. But this, you know, this is the first time he's obviously actually had like a live fight. You know, in the second round, he looks like he kind of had, you know, Morrison kind of backed up and against the ropes. He looked like he was going to jump on him like he always does, you know, because kind of Eubank has that kind of attitude that, you know, as soon as you hurt, he'll just jump on you and throw like combination after combination after combination. But he kind of took a step back, let Morrison kind of come off the ropes and let him back into the fight because he wanted to get obviously more rounds. I see, I'm not too sure, because he, you know, you saw him at the end of the fight, he took a lot of punishment. He took a lot of punishment that he didn't really need to take. He was pretty beaten up, you know, facially. And that was one of the things that I thought, you know, he didn't look good, you know, his lack of head movement. You could see at times he was kind of like showboating and doing a few little Roy Jones Jr. type of things in the ring. You know, going off that performance against, you know, Marcus Morrison, who's probably more British level than world level, I don't know if Eubank's really come on a lot. You know, he always looks fit, looks strong. I wouldn't have said he's a natural boxer. He doesn't really have like much finesse. He just very, very dedicated and works real hard. You know, he's in a very, very strong division. And I just don't know, like, could he pick up, you know, like a world title? Maybe if he goes after somebody like Morata. I know they've talked about fighting Andrade. I think Andrade's all wrong for him. I think Andrade's boxing IQ is far superior to Chris Eubank Jr. You know, he's very slick, loves to counter. Eubank Jr. is very one-dimensional. So it's literally the perfect matchup for somebody like Andrade in terms of style. I think fighting somebody like Morata would be more, you know, down Eubank's route. And obviously the rest of the titles are, you know, with Canelo.
See, but I think if a potential Eubank Jr. and Andrade fight, I agree. I think Andrade would be the favorite. I think the style is all wrong for Eubank Jr., but in terms of, you know, for Andrade's sake, and even for Eubank's sake, Eubank at least has some type of weight behind his name. And Andrade needs names, you know, just like we talked about. So just because of that, I wouldn't mind seeing it. I wouldn't mind seeing it just to have them be able to associate with each other and fight each other just for the name recognition, you know, just to kind of get some attention.
And then Charlo, right? He's the WBC in that division, right?
Right, right. But I mean, who has he really fought as well?
Originally, it looked like that's the kind of the route they were going down, because obviously at that time, I think, you know, Chris Eubank Jr. had that short contract with the PBC, you know, until he was picked up by, Wasserman. So, it would be interesting. I think Andrade is all wrong for him, but in terms of, you know, fighting a big name, fighting for a world title, easy to make and probably a good payday, you know, I could see Eubank, you know, maybe taking that. Murata, I think, would be a better option. Charlo would, you know, probably be a decent option. You know, Charlo is hittable, doesn't move an awful lot, you know, but he is big, he's strong, and, you know, he fought Derry Vinchenko, right? And obviously he had that great performance. You know, that was kind of the one for me personally where I thought, you know, Charlo is legit after that performance, because, you know, Derry Vinchenko is very good, very
skilled. No, right. Yeah. I think obviously he's a threat there. But I was mentioning it more when you compare him to the 154 Charlo, who's fought more of the competitive names in his division. I think Eubank and an Andrade fight, or Eubank and Charlo, Eubank and Andrade more than a Eubank Charlo fight, but, where are they really going to go from here? You know, is Eubank Jr. really going to be able to win another world title at 160 pounds? Like, and when I say other world title, I mean, you know, it's if you want to recognize the IBO title as a world title. You know, we had Ed Levine on in a past episode, how he talked about their system and their rankings. And we know that these other sanctioning bodies and world titles have relationships with promoters who have big television contracts, big television platforms, so it helps legitimize and market their world titles. So it's a lot easier. I think for Eubank, I mean, if I was Andrade, I would take that fight. I mean, Andrade doesn't seem like he's going to be able to get anybody else, you know, like even Triple G doesn't want to fight him. And I think Triple G is a big favorite over him, even at 30, what is he, 38? But I don't know. Maybe Triple G fights a Eubank Jr. in the future. I don't know, but I don't know. They're in Eubank, and I wouldn't say maybe Andrade even with a title, but Eubank is just in a tough spot at 160 pounds. And he keeps trying to come back and find his, wherever his space is, at 160 pounds. I mean, what do you think?
No, it's true. No, it's true. I know that they've looked at, you know, when he signed this deal with Wasserman, I know Kawasarland was kind of saying, come back, have a comeback fight, which was obviously this one, then fight somebody, you know, a little bit bigger, a little more well-known. And then I think at the end of the year, they were looking towards, I think they actually did mention, you know, Triple G. So, you know, that is good. And, you know, the Triple G fight would be a great fight. I think obviously they'd both stand and just bang, you know, and it'd just be a case of how much does Triple G have left, you know, in the tank.
Right. No, yeah, that's true. Yeah. But rounding off the episode here of the last round this week, news and notes, the state of Florida here in the United States will no longer test boxers or MMA fighters for marijuana. The change was based on a recommendation from the Association of Boxing Commissions, also known as ABC, their medical advisory committee, as well as the UFC's anti-doping policy run by the United States Anti-Doping Agency, also known as USADA. What'd you think about this change? And is this going to, you know, eventually flow to the rest of the boxing commissions in the United States?
I think it probably will. I think, you know, a lot of places, you know, their outlook on marijuana has changed a great deal. Obviously, you know, it's, you know, legal in a lot of states. And then obviously, you know, a lot of people are now using stuff like CBD. So, you know, a lot of, you know, sports companies and stuff like that are sponsored by CBD brands. So, you know, I think a lot of that's probably helped as well. So, I mean, that's just going to suck for people like, you know, obviously, you know, Nick Diaz in the UFC who tested positive for marijuana and ended up getting like a 4-year ban, you know, back in the day. And, you know, now they're making it legal. So it kind of, you know, sucks for him. But, you know, at the time when he was taking it, it was banned. So, you know, he shouldn't have done it. But it's just, you know, fast forward into now, you're looking at it and it's legal. It kind of does suck for people that got banned for it back in the day.
Right. Yeah, we'll see as time moves on. And then also Ryan Garcia, as we touched on last week, he had pulled out from his upcoming fight in July against Javier Fortuna to focus on his health and well-being, according to his social media post last week. He just recently posted something tonight, I believe, recently within the last few hours. Can you read to our listeners read to our listeners what exactly the post says?
So he posted this on his, you know, Instagram story saying, "I'm seeing a lot of people talk about what they think is going on with me. I'm struggling every day and I'm hurting emotionally so bad. If anyone has experienced anxiety and depression at high levels, they knows that just because you smile and act as if things are okay doesn't mean they are. I'm writing this with shock and I'm hurting more. I won't do anything to try and be happy. Bye. You are all sick ass people." Not a great way to end it, but I can see why
he needs to get off social media. Like, the fact that he posted that last week and he posted that this week means that he's still on it. And that's not helping his health. He needs to get out of it. He needs to get out of it. All the consistent, you know, statements and supporting statements, I guess, that I've seen towards him after his withdrawing of the Javier Fortuna fight and for his health reasons. I've seen a lot of people say, and a lot of marquee and respectable boxing minds in the boxing community have said that he needs to get off social media. There's a lot of people in his generation who are just stuck on social media. They just can't get off of it. And it affects them. Him, you know, whether it's him who listens to the critics or whatever's going on out there, or somebody who sends him like, "Hey, did you see what this person said? Or did you see what this tweet was or what this post was, what they're saying about you?" Whether it's that or it's him kind of searching and looking for all the negative criticism or whatever's coming at him, it doesn't matter. He needs to get away from it. He needs a digital detox. He needs to get off of it, man. Like, him releasing that statement, like, it just tells me that he's still on his phone. He's still on social media watching everything, or people are sending him, all the negative reactions or whatever, what he views as negative reactions. I mean, I don't know. I like we said last week, we wish the kid well, and whatever he's going through, you know, we wish him well. 'Cause when he does come back, he's very polarizing. So obviously people pay attention, especially the younger fans, and, you know, it gets boxing a lot of attention. So we love when boxing gets attention. Well, not all the attention, especially at the, you know, not something like Felix Verdejo attention, but you know, he needs to detox. He needs a digital detox. He needs to get out of the social media realm and take a break and really kind of focus on himself. 'Cause that just tells me that he's not. That, you know, but it is what it is. You know, he needs to, like I said, I feel like we're a broken record here. You know, good luck to him. Hopefully he gets the help he needs, but he needs to take it off. Like, delete his social media. Maybe he's too afraid. I mean, obviously it's worth a lot of money. Or at least delete the apps. Delete the apps from your phone. Delete them from everything. You know, you don't have to delete your account, but I don't know, man. I don't know. Hey, we'll see how it moves, how it goes on moving forward. But I don't think, I say by the end of the year, him and Golden Boy split. What do you think?
Yeah. On the situation itself, I think the problem he has is his whole celebrity, like his whole like identity as such is social media. You know, he is as big as he is because of social media. But I know, I do agree with you. I think, you know, he needs to, you know, detox, like you said, you know, and get away from it all, because the fact that he's putting stuff out there means, I think, he's still reading it, which is still affecting him. And you know, social media isn't a nice place. But in, I think he may still be with Golden Boy because I just don't know whether we'll see him back in by the end of the year. I think, you know, Oscar and Carey, obviously his little buddy, Mario Lopez, kind of need to, you know, watch what they said, because I was kind of surprised by what they said on, you know, the three knockdown rule, you know, the fact that he'd gone away with, you know, depression, anxiety, and they were pretty much calling him a liar.
I wasn't really surprised, man, because like I said before, Mario Lopez and Oscar De La Hoya are good friends. They showed that on social media. If you kind of follow them, they're good friends and they've been good friends for a long time. I think De La Hoya tells Mario Lopez a lot of things. I think they're comfortable like that, which is, you know, that's cool. I mean, everybody has their confidant or whoever, you know, and it is what it is. You know, maybe they were just frustrated, or Mario Lopez, excuse me, like, cause he, you know, was just as frustrated because Oscar De La Hoya was frustrated. Or like I said last week, Mario Lopez even said that DAZN asked Golden Boy if they said this was real. You know, like, is this real? Is he really pulling out for this? Like, they didn't believe it was actually real. So it is what it is, man. I mean, you know, there's a lot of money invested in Ryan Garcia, and you know, you're trying to move him up, but then, like, you know, everybody on both sides has you know, some blame for the whole situation since they signed the kid. But you know, what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do when Ryan Garcia got Guadalupe Valencia? He's that lawyer who represents a lot of PBC fighters. That's when I knew. I was like, oh yeah, this is taking a turn for the worse in terms of that relationship between Golden Boy and Ryan Garcia. You know, like, and Golden Boy put Ryan Garcia to train with Eddie Reynoso and Canelo. That was their idea. They went to Eddie Reynoso and they said, you know, would you be willing to train him? They set that up. And I don't know, man, that whole situation just sucks. And, you know, whatever he's going through, like we said, good luck. I hope he gets the help he needs. But, you know, just based on that post he just posted where he's calling out everybody and he's upset, like, he doesn't need to do that. He doesn't need to do that. He just needs to get off social media, because that's just going to make him worse. You know, I don't know. All right. Good luck to him. Hopefully he comes back. He takes some time off and figures it out and focuses on himself and comes back with a vengeance. But I thought he was going to come back with a vengeance after the biggest win of his career against Luke Campbell. He was on a roll, you know, but who knows? We'll see how the rest of the year plays out for Ryan Garcia's career. But on a potentially exciting note, Joseph Diaz Jr., who's also a former world champion at 130 pounds and a Golden Boy fighter, has thrown his name in the mix to replace him in the Javier Fortuna fight, which I think is great. I think that's a pretty good matchup too. And if that happens, I'd be cool with it. You know, I like it. You know, I think Joseph Diaz Jr. is a great fighter. I remember watching him.
That's a tricky fight.
Yeah, I think it's a great fight.
That's because he's stepping up in weight, right?
Yeah, he's going from 130 to 135.
Yeah, and that's what, two weight divisions he stepped up in recent times, and he doesn't hit hard.
Right. I think for Joseph Diaz Jr. is actually a good thing, because it shows that he's like, yeah, I'm down, let me fight you. And he moves up a weight class. It's just kind of like back in the day with Amir Khan or Kell Brook. Obviously they went up two weight classes in a sense, but they went up to 160 or whatever pounds, 155 pounds, to fight Canelo and Triple G. And they got a lot of publicity about it. They got a lot of credit for it, you know, in a smaller way. I can see Joseph Diaz Jr. Getting the same thing. Like, hey, even if he loses, just, hey man, I just want to show people that I'm down to fight. I took it like 2 months before or whatever to replace. I moved up a weight class and I'm down, you know. And if he loses, you know, he just goes back down to 130. So I think it works out for him, man. And I hope he gets the fight. I really hope he gets the fight.
Oh, I do. I mean, huge respect for him to do that, you know, just kind of old school, like you said, you know, guys just being like, hey, I'll take it. Kind of like the UFC, a fight drops off, someone hits them up, like, hey, I'll take it. And then people step in. Full credit. And I'm, you know, I like to see, more guys do that.
Yeah. Didn't John Ryder, I think I saw a report that John Ryder is on his way to Dallas just in case Billy Joe Saunders falls out as the opponent. He's willing to step in against Canelo.
Yeah, Boxing News actually put that. That was who I saw release that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, hey, I don't think he's going to get the fight, but I'm sure he's going to be like, hey, man, if it happens, I'm right here. So it's worth a shot. It's definitely worth a shot. You never know. You never know. But big thanks once again to our guest of the week in the Ring Magazines and the Neutral Corners, Michael Montero. We appreciate him joining us this week. We know he was on the East Coast, so he was a couple hours ahead of us here on the West Coast. So we definitely appreciate his valued time. And as we sign off here and this episode for the last round, Mike, go ahead and let our fans know where they can find us and follow us, and also plug our shirts and our merchandise.
We're at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And obviously join us next week. We'll be reviewing the Canelo Billy Joe Saunders fight and then previewing the big heavyweight clash between your favorite and mine, Christopher One Shot Lovejoy.
I'm ready.
Against Manuel Cha.
I'm ready. Unless Don King, I think Don King's going to come in at the 11th hour. So, but we'll talk about that next week. But I think Don King's going to bring down the wrath of Don King again. So, but as I mentioned, we do have shirts and sweaters with Fit Warrior brand. The links are on my Twitter handle, and I think some links are on our last round handles and stuff like that on social media. So if you can support us, we have some shirts on there. Actually a shirt, to all black shirt. It's pretty simple, not too crazy. We don't have too crazy tattoo inspired designs or anything like that, but we have a sweater and a shirt. If you can spend your hard-earned money on a shirt or a sweater from us, we appreciate it. We'll shout you out if you let us know you bought one, and we'll repost you on social media. You know, all the support and help we can get, we would appreciate it. For our guest of the weekend, Michael Montero, for my co-host Michael Shepherd, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast.